Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Super Negotiate. It's my first series of 2025. And as a procurement manager, the only activity that I will be focusing on for let's say next 1 week or so is to set up my KPIs. So I'm going to be speaking about 10 KPIs in this video. And I'm going to give you two perspectives. Now, you can easily ChatGPT some of the stuff. Maybe you'll get even better ideas. But let's accept the fact the procurement KPIs, at least 70 to 80%, have not evolved. So you would still be talking about savings and cycle times and supplier management and contract compliance, delivery times, etc., etc. But I want us to think forward. Is there a better way? Is there a more advanced way to measure some of the effectiveness of these KPIs? So let's get started. I'm going to be giving you two kinds of KPIs. One kind of the KPI is the traditional route. Now, I know we would still be following some of the traditional KPIs. At the same time, I would also be giving you some of my favorites to what I think how industry should move forward. So I will be calling these as, let's say, top 1% teams KPI. Okay, so let's get started. The first KPI is always going to be the savings KPI. And it's a bit of a debate between savings, right? So CFOs will always complain, I don't see savings in my balance sheet or P&L. And I kind of accept that because if you're not releasing cash at the end of the day, these are fictitious numbers that we're dealing with. So as a KPI, savings will stand. So there you go. For the basic teams, the saving is there. For that top 1% team, let's imagine category managers as the product manager or the product CEOs. So my category, I run the category. And I would want to know if I improve the cost of the product by 1% due to my category's contribution, how much profit margin or operating margin am I improving? It's a very difficult ask, right? Because when you understand procurement in a very traditionalist way, when you're running RFPs and RFQs and ERAs, you kind of lose the sense of exactly what am I doing in terms of improving the cost percentage. So maybe the profit margin, operating margin milestone for the category manager is still 1 or 2 or 3 years away. But if you have to jump through the hoops of transitioning yourself from the traditional mindset to, let's say, the mindset of the top 1% team, you have to talk about an operating margin improvement percentages. So for the traditional teams, savings KPI stays. For the top 1% team, you're talking about percentage improvement in the operating margin because of your category innovations. Now let's unpack, even for the traditional teams, the savings KPI. For me, the only way to measure savings is how much I was paying last year versus how much am I paying this year on the actual PO that gets released and receipted. There are various scenarios, and that's where some of the procurement team lose the credibility when you try to sell cost avoidance as cost saving. The cost avoidance in general scenario is anything difference between the first quotation and your final quotation. That's cost avoidance. So if you have to capture, try to segregate cost avoidance from cost saving under two classes. And that's the tip I'm going to be leaving you with. That's the end of the savings KPI. Now let's move to the second KPI, shall we? The second KPI, again, is a very traditional KPI, cycle time KPI. How many days you will take to complete this RFP or RFQ? How many days can I expect the POs to go out after I have released my purchase requisition? You know, all those cycle times from PR creation date to the purchase order creation date. Age old KPI, nothing has been innovated. It also doesn't account in terms of how complex the requirement you might be handling. You may be dealing with a very bad stakeholder who has absolutely no idea about the budget, the requirement, the scope, and hence your cycle time keeps on extending. You may also be giving up, let's say, one more shot at reducing the prices by introducing, let's say, additional round of suppliers or additional round of negotiation if someone is catching you with, hey, you are on the clock to complete the sourcing event, right? Nobody wants to have that kind of a pressure. So I think the cycle time KPI is, let's say, important, but it has to evolve. You should not compromise on the possible cost reductions, or let's say even finding a better deal, just because you are on the clock, right? So for the traditional teams, if I want to stay with the traditional KPIs of cycle time, please do so. However, for the top 1% team, let's evolve from just being measured how quickly you're able to turn around things in cycle time. Let's move to something what we call as speed to market the product. So for example, if your marketing or a sales team has identified, we want to launch a new product, a new SKU in the market. How fast can I get the materials? How fast can I turn around the production? How fast can I turn around the shipping so that I have that product in my dealer's or consumer's hand? Whether it's 30 days, 20 days, 25 days, what is the timeline that we're talking about? Now, when you will talk in this kind of vocabulary with your chief sales officer or marketing officer, you immediately get a very strategic kind of a conversation, because you have to now backtrack every single thing. And it's not concept that I'm talking about. Imagine the every iPhone launch that happens, they announce a specific day, right? And they work out supply chains accordingly. So you anticipate and then you plan. Speed to market is what I think cycle time should be. But if you must follow the cycle time KPI, try to follow these timelines in 2025. RFQ, 3 days. Straight up, off the book, off the shelf purchase, catalog purchases, 3 days. RFP, if you must, try to conclude it in 30 to 40 days. Now, a lot of traditional manufacturing or any other industry companies will be screaming out, I have absolutely no idea what I'm talking about, because it takes months to finalize even the scope of work. And I understand that. But let's also get to the fact, if we are only saving 10%, if we are only saving 10%, and then you're delaying the whole sales cycle by 3 months by running your complex RFP, are you also taking into the fact that you're losing out on sale and profit margins? So what exactly do you gain if you delay the sourcing process by 3 months or 5 months or 6 months just because your RFP is going on? And that's the mindset I think any new CPO will be having. How fast can I actually get the final product in my consumer's hand? It's not the responsibility of the sales team. It's the responsibility of procurement as well to make sure the product is available at the lowest or the best cost possible. And if it means that you have to cut corners to, let's say, pay a 5% premium, that accelerates your product launch time, let's say significantly, 30-40% faster, might as well do that, right? Because you gain in terms of the sales. So let's have the holistic picture. That was about the cycle time. The third is talk of the town. Digitization KPIs. Everyone is talking about GenAI these days. So many tools are out there. When you look at the magic quadrants, when you look at all the spider maps, I think it's getting really complicated to understand what exactly is going on. So many logos, so many new classes. Where do you want to get started, right? And I want to bring some sense into it. The traditionalist mindset is measuring the adoption. They will force people to use the tool. They will monitor who's not using the tool and they will penalize. They will organize 200 training sessions every other week to make sure people remember the name of the tool. But they forget that then this is a continuous cycle. And you lose out what's the bigger objective of even getting the tool. I'm a pro-digitization guy. Yet I understand how e-sourcing, spend analysis, contract management, ERPs work. But if there is a tool which is not needed, then don't force it. If your Excel spreadsheets works just fine for one small niche use case that you have, don't force a generic web form just because you want to push for the digitization. Again, digitization for the basic industries. And I'm now returning to the whole talk of KPIs. For the basic teams, digitization should be about utilization of the data points. Are you really using the data, right? And again, even if you're basic, I still don't force you or recommend you to use adoption. It's a very poor way of promoting digitization in your organization. So for basic as well as, let's say, advanced team, what is the percentage of data that you're utilizing should be the KPI. Usage. And when you talk about usage, you're basically talking about use cases. So for me, I've always been a fan of maintaining library of use cases. At any given point of time, I will have at least 30 to 50 use cases planned, all categorized in terms of what will be their business impact, what will be your complexity of implementing, right? And then I decide which technology I want to push through. We'll talk about this in some other video if you want me to. But digitization KPI, move away from the adoption-based KPIs and go into the utilization-based KPIs. That's what I am recommending. That's the end of the third KPI. Moving on to the fourth KPI, which I call is a supplier management KPI, right? Traditional mindsets, you will talk about how much delivery time compliance there is. Is it delivered on time? Is it delivered on full? I don't want to demean this KPI, but this is largely what supply relationship management has been restricted to. If you want to follow that, establish supplier management KPI in 2025 as well. But if you want to, let's say, take it a bit step up, let's say you want to innovate in this KPI, what I really want is you to identify two classes in supplier management. Don't get me wrong. The delivery time and the quality performance stays. And for me, it's more like, you don't really have to set a KPI for it because it's now bare minimum. Why should I work with a supplier that is consistently delaying my deliveries? So if you can't meet my delivery timelines and if you can't provide me with a quality product, don't work with me, right? And that's a very different approach from a KPI. That's the bare minimum standard. I don't want to work with suppliers who are below, let's say, 80% of my this KPI. Why should I spend my time managing corrective action reports for the suppliers who are consistently non-performing, right? So we set the bare minimum benchmark, and then that's for the basic team. It's for the top 1% team. For the supplier management, I want to have only two metrics. One, how many cost innovation projects am I running with this supplier, right? And the cost innovation projects can be whether any cost models that you have changed, you might be following, for example, in any raw material based industry, you will always follow index based costing formulas, right? For example, you can take LME index and then using the price of copper, you can add some yield factors and some other costs to arrive at the final price. That's normally how most of the raw materials procurement is done. Now, as a cost innovation project, have you worked out a plan with any one or two of your strategic suppliers to take a relook at, can I change this index-based formula to some other index? Maybe I want to improve on the yield because of the productivity. Can I do something in my production line so that my yield factor improves, hence the overall cost of the product comes down? For the CapEx-based industries, it could be should cost modeling, where you take the product apart, you take out the features that you really are not using or it's not used by your consumers. And that's the insight you get from your sales team. And then you strip out all the non-required features, basically to work out a lighter version of your product with the reduced cost. It's not possible for you to do these kind of projects in isolation. That's why you need 1, 2, 3, 4 strategic suppliers to work on these long-term projects so that you can improve quality of your costing, of your product, etc. This is what I call as supply innovation. One heads up though, it's a bit different from just pushing the new products, right? I've seen so many interactions getting failed at this. A supplier who's really not interested in, or maybe our account manager, right? Because it's the account manager at your supplier side who really decides what kind of service you will be getting. So if your supplier account manager pushes the launches of the new products and use this supplier innovation as just another sales opportunity, you need to stop that immediately. I'm talking about engagement at a strategic level. You may have to invest into setting up a tear down asset lab you may have to co-invest with your suppliers to find a third party who can specialize in the services. But again, it's a long-term commitment of making sure you are working on some big strategic cost innovation project. That's one. The second part is, we will cover it in the risk management, but let me say it out anyway. For the non-performing suppliers, you will always want to have a metric. And for me, it will be percentage of the contracts that are at risk. Now, and I use this very casually. I define risk as bad performance, like I mentioned. I define risk as concentration. I define risk as single source dependency, etc., etc., right? So how much of your contracts are really at the risk is how I monitor. But you understand the supplier management aspect. Let's move beyond OTIF, on-time in full concepts, to something what I called as innovation and percentage contracts under risk. So that was the supplier management KPI. Let's move to the next one, which I call is as spend analysis, or let's say, let's call it as a spend analysis KPI. Not many teams will have it, even if you're a basic procurement setup. I recommend you have the spend monitor or spend management KPI. The purpose of this KPI is to basically tell you in one snapshot what's your coverage, in what elements of your procurement you are in control at, right? So you will have sub KPIs under this would be contract under management, spend under management, how much of your spend that you are managing is covered using the contracts. Not everything that you buy will be having a contract, right? You can also add elements of purchase price variance and tail spend management, right? My favorite topic these days. So depending upon how mature your organization is, you can take either one KPI, which is spend under management, so that you have more central spend and less local spend. And if you are into top 1% aspect, you can have more elements to it like tail spend management and purchase price variance, especially when you're running a multi-geography operation and your teams are sitting across various geographies, you will have a lot of tail spend consolidation problems. More than the tail spend, you will have purchase price variance. So you will find numerous cases of vendor master data getting duplicated. People are buying same thing from two different suppliers. Or in fact, people are buying from the same supplier, same thing at two different occasions, right? And you need a lot of spend analysis to really get hold of this stuff. So I'll make a separate video again if you really want me to make on this, because these are very exciting detailed projects. But as a KPI, get this spend analysis. It basically will give you what your category manager is up to. So as if I have to give you an example, if I have 60%, let's say, coverage via the spend, and then the total spend is 100%, you will basically question, where is that 40% spend going? Who's handling, whether it's a one-time expense, etc., right? So have this as a bare minimum KPI in your 2025. The sixth KPI is the working capital KPI. Sometimes this KPI will sit in supply chain teams, but I think it should be a procurement KPI. In very simple terms, it's basically the result of your negotiation of your payment terms in the procurement negotiations. Let me give an example. Sometimes your buyers will agree to discounts like 20% discount. In CAPEX industries, CAPEX purchases, it's very common for someone to have, let's say, payment upon shipping documents, which is again is a basically an advance because you haven't received the material yet, right? So a lot of things that you negotiate during the commercial round affects how much money your organization needs to have in the bank. And especially when you look at the things holistically, if you are agreeing with your supplier to pay him, let's say, 20% advance and 50% against shipping documents, bill of lading, etc., then basically means the 70% is to be paid upfront, right? Within 20 days or 30 days from the PO date, right? Wherever the shipping is happening. But your organization will receive money from your customer maybe after 90 days or something. Now you see the problem that your organization now has to carry the money because you will keep on negotiating such terms. There have been many case studies where working capital has been on a negative, meaning you pay your vendors after, but you collect the money from the customer upfront. Amazon, does it ring a bell? They collect money from you upfront, but they pay the vendors after a certain time, right? So that's how negative working capital works out. So I want both the basics team and the top 1% team to have this as a KPI. But depending upon your scenario, you can set up the target of how closer do you want to get at the negative working capital KPI. As a top 1% procurement team, I would love to go towards the negative working capital KPI. So that was about the payment terms. There's one more thing which is extremely important when it comes to working capital is something called inventory days, right? How much inventory are you guys really keeping in your warehouse? I really want to spin this off as another KPI, so I'll name it as number 7. So how much safety stock are you keeping? When people are issuing at purchase requisition, in how many days of inventory you're having? Remember the case studies that we did on Nike has an over inventory problem. And you will see this happening over and over and over again, right? So what is your current inventory level? When we talk about top 1% teams, not only they have, let's say, a lean inventory to begin with, right? And you want to maybe transition out. It's very difficult for me to really give you how much inventory days you want to have. But the top 1% team will start establishing vendor-managed warehouses, vendor-managed inventory, like they call it. They would want to have near-shoring efforts to de-risk the supply chain. So whenever there's a shipping disruption, which is very common these days, to what extent you really have to rush and place purchase order in advance. For example, if there is a semiconductor crisis again, would you rush and place 5 months of order in advance? Now, if that is how you will react, you are basically having a very dated supply chain practice, right? You are basically putting all the efforts of organization and working capital at risk just because you are fearing something will go out of stock. So let's place 6 months of orders in advance. That's an inefficient way of doing supply chain or a purchasing or a procurement. Rather, you should be having enough confidence to say, yeah, I would probably source 20% from my nearshoring efforts. I have this much stock available already in the vendor-managed warehouse. I will ask my vendors to increase the inventory in their books so that I don't have to take, let's say, the hit of the working capital on my books. And I would still have access to 3 months or 4 months supply at any given point of time. Maybe you will establish warehouses nearer to your factory if there are incidents of, let's say, truck strikes or labor strikes or port strikes, anything. And this is how you work out your supply chain operations. Again, if you are still fighting the supply chain disruptions by placing purchase orders in bulk quantity in advance, I think that's inefficient way, and that's a very irresponsible way of fixing the problem and a very expensive way too. So number 7 done, inventory days. Try to get into the vendor managed inventory. Try to get into how much nearshoring efforts you have been able to establish. So reduction of overseas shipments out of your total percentage in total shipments, right? How much domestic shipments you are having versus how much total imported shipments are you having is what I will establish as a KPI for top 1% teams. The number 8 is about risk management. Basic setup. Just establish a risk management KPI, and we spoke about this concept. What percentage of single source suppliers, what percentage of your suppliers are dependent upon you? So if you stop giving them business, will they go bankrupt? And there are various ways of spinning this around. My favorite topic has been these days in terms of exposing the risk is what's the supplier revenue size to what size of business that they're handling for your organization. And if that ratio exceeds 1, then for me, it's alarm bells already, right? And you will be surprised how common that scenario is when you're dealing with, let's say, distributors, when you're dealing with anything which is basically an agent, and you're not dealing with the OEMs. So the agents would rely upon margins. So you have to really understand if you're paying your, let's say, the agent in between after 60 days of shipment and the order is a big size, how well can he really fund that assessment? Because his payment term may be sooner, right? So always have that lens. But that's for the basic team. Do your risk management. You can add supply concentration in there. You can have category concentration, basically how much reliant you are on that supplier. So for example, if you're dealing with a single source vendor who is basically having a patent or having the monopoly, you are having 100% reliance. So what will happen if that product is suddenly short, shoots up by 200%? Would you really pay 200% to that supplier, or would you shut down that product line? This is how basically the risk management works. People would also bring in the elements of measuring macroeconomics, geopolitics, all these buzzwords. And in my view, most of these things are reactionary. You can't really predict any geopolitical macroeconomic factors. So all these are good for discussions, but they don't really model up in any kind of action, right? It's good talk, what I call it as a water cooler chat, right? But it doesn't really translate into action. People will not issue out POs based upon gossips. So while you can have that kind of a discussion, as I said, as a water cooler chat, but for anything meaningful, you really have to factor in the elements which you can control and take actions on. So for example, risk management, I will have cybersecurity for top 1% teams. How vulnerable your suppliers are to a cybersecurity attack. So your suppliers are now more exposed towards this cybersecurity attacks, right? So to what extent, if the cybersecurity attack happens, your supplier will lose the ability to ship the product, or you will lose the confidential data, and what will the impact? This is what I will, let's say, manage as a risk, because it can happen anytime. I've already spoken about nearshoring percentages. I would probably add it here to what percent of your total shipments or spend you're able to bring under the nearshoring, meaning the domestic shipments versus the overseas shipment. When I talk about domestic shipment, I am not saying buy domestically. We will cover that KPI later. What I'm basically saying is force your supplier to establish local warehouses and force them to keep the product there, which is not on your books, but you can make a phone call and ask them to ship it out in hours rather than through a transit vessel, which takes 30 days on average, right? The last thing I would add in the risk management, and again, we have covered this, but I will state it out again, is contracts at risk. So all your troublemaker suppliers, single source, monopolistic suppliers, poor performance suppliers, suppliers in risky areas, if I use the words loosely, to what percent of these contracts are at risk? And what can you do to, let's say, reduce that percentage spend? So if you have 5% of your spend with the troublemakers, can you reduce it to 3%? This is how top 1% team will continue to work. All right, 8 KPI is done. We are moving to number 9 KPI, and it's popping up, and it's extremely important. It's something called sustainability KPI. And as far as the procurement is concerned, the most important KPI in sustainability is scope 3 KPI. Basically, what emissions your suppliers are emitting while manufacturing the product for you is what we call as scope 3 KPI. I can tell you about scope 1 and scope 2. Basically, scope 1 and scope 2 are the activities that are happening in your factory, in your organization, and those, let's say, are easier to control because you can invest. You can invest in better technology, more efficient products to reduce the emissions. But scope 3 is extremely complicated. If I remember the statistic correctly, 80% of your emissions are happening via scope 3. So that's why it's a beast to manage. Now, people have been throwing tools to solve the scope 3 problem, which is basically, again, it makes me so angry. And I'm sorry to say this, but just putting a dashboard and a form and asking people to update the values so that you can throw a pretty chart at me is not how you reduce scope 3 emissions. It's almost equal to ignoring, right? What's the right way to do it? Again, for the basic teams, you can start with spend-based approach. What percentage of your suppliers are basically working on environmental-related projects for reducing their emissions? And you can continue to improve that percentage. So for example, you can have 20% of your supplier this year who are actively working on reducing their emissions, and you can collect the list of those projects and then improve that to 60% and then 80%. And then you can keep on happening, progressing like that. That's for the basic teams. For the top 1% team, they will move away from spend-based approach to something called emission-based approach. So exactly the same stuff. Identify your suppliers who are emitting maximum amount of emissions when it comes to you. And then let's say track on a quarterly basis whether they are able to reduce their emissions. And then say by 2027 or 2028 or 2030, you will reduce the emission by 2% or 5% or 10%, whatever is feasible. But again, you're moving away from a spend-based approach to something called what we call as emission-based approach. And it's actually funny, the spend-based approach. And it is funny to me because to buy a more efficient device who's technically superior than my dated technology, I have to spend more money, right? So that means my spend can go up because I'm buying better devices. But if you're using the spend-based approach, it will look like your emissions are going up. And I'm not making this up because that's the approach being followed by a lot of industry people today. And I don't blame them because we are still very new in this scope 3 concept. But this spend-based approach has flaws which are fundamentally misaligned to how emissions should be measured. So again, start with spend-based approach if you have to keep things simple, but then you have to change your approach to something called emission-based approach. All right, last thing is about people, upskilling. And it's most important in the era of digitization. And if you are a basic procurement team, it's even more important for you because you have to now progress to top 1% team. Upskilling, if you're a basic procurement setup, do these 3-4 trainings, spend analysis, absolutely important. I cannot stress enough how much value you are losing every single day because you are not analyzing the spend data in the right way. And don't assume that by buying an expensive spend analysis suite, which is nothing but probably a collection of a million dashboards, will solve your problem. It's not going to work if you do not know how to make use of that data. So for example, if I have to do my tailspend analysis and someone is throwing 6 charts at me, which shows Pareto analysis of 80-20, blah, 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 I would be like, fine, then, but what exactly I need to do? Where is my action plan? And to work out that action plan, you need to follow a series of steps. I have made tons of videos on spend analysis. There's a book available. Feel free to browse through it. I'm even doing a spend analysis training. I don't know what else to do, how to make you believe that the biggest superpower that you have today is your spend data. Drop everything. If you have even $100 to invest in one tool, invest in a spend analysis practice. So, but it starts with to make sure your people know how to do spend analysis. So that's the first course I would train your people in. The second is about negotiations. Again, people, if they are running from RFPs to RFPs, RFQs to RFQs, they will not focus upon how to extract maximum value by pulling the RFPs in. Most of the buyers would not go that extra mile. That means your organization ends up leaving money on the table, even when, let's say, the cycle times allowances are available. Especially when your negotiation approach does not change. So I always keep asking people, if you have to negotiate a $10,000 spend from the $100,000 spend, from a $1 million spend, from a $50 million spend, or a $100 million spend, how will you change your negotiation strategy? And if your buyers are unable to answer this in granular details, you have a problem that you need to fix. You need to tell people how to negotiate. And this is where my shameless hook comes in. This is what I'm working at Super Negotiate, the open source community. And I always ask people, if you can't tell me in granular detail, how will you negotiate a $10,000 spend from $100,000, from a $1 million to a $10 million to a $100 million? And you can't work out the steps, then you definitely need this training. And all the content is available online for free. All it needs is your time and basically grit. Navigate to my YouTube channel and look for something called Negotiation, Hard Negotiation Series, and also something called T60, a 60-day step-by-step program. It's free. I'm not charging anything. All right. So if you have to train your people, start with spend analysis, go into negotiation. People can come and teach you how to run e-sourcing events. Click there, click here, etc. Contract management. This is how you upload. Forget that. I don't want you to spend anything on tools training. Tools will come and go, right? You're not pushing for adoption. You're pushing for data usage. So how many data use cases your people are having? Are they even able to think in that terms? And when I see the spend data today, I see 1,000 use cases. And that's what I'm saying. The most powerful data that you have today is your e-sourcing and ERP data. And these are the two things that you should be training your people in. Spend analysis and negotiation. Forget everything else, even Gen AI. It'll take care of itself, right? And this is where I would go into something called top 1% teams now. Spend analysis, they are pros. Negotiations, they are pros. They have their playbooks developed, how to measure, how to judge everything out. Now, there are two trainings I want to develop for top 1% team. A, I want procurement managers to be familiarized with codings. Very unusual, right? But I want procurement managers to be able to think and code like data scientists so that they are able to work out all these simulations. They are able to reduce all these admin tasks without relying upon somebody else to do it. And I'm taking up a challenge, which I will announce separately, but it's very possible for a procurement manager today who understand even the basics of coding to really craft out how many game theory scenarios, and I will come to game theory. How many scenarios of my negotiations are possible? Work out this linear programming for me and tell me which is the most optimized way of awarding a supplier share, 20% to this supplier, 70% to that supplier. These are basic concepts. But again, make sure your procurement managers are spending at least 2 hours a week or 3 hours a month, whatever it is, and they are learning how to code, how to think like data scientists. A data scientist can learn procurement, but he or she will never be that much effective unless she puts in equal amount of hours to become a category manager. So I find it easier for category managers to become data scientists. And when you have that kind of talent available, then you are basically substituting 4 people, data analyst, data scientist, maybe a team who will buy the tool for you and the category manager with this one person. It's super valuable. So invest time in making sure your procurement talent is becoming a procurement data scientist. If you don't know how to start, I will teach you how to become a data scientist when you are a procurement manager. I used to be a procurement manager. I invested my time. I have developed my method how to become a procurement data scientist. DM me, I'll give you my playbook. And the last thing is game theory. It's connected with my negotiation point, but for the top 1% team, when they have worked out the basic, they want to excel at game theory. If there is one skill, forget everything I have said in this video. There's one skill where I want you to train your teams on is the game theory. Learn about Nash equilibriums. Learn about how to anticipate what's the possible best optimal solution is that. Is there any optimal solutions? It's very easy for people to assume they have expertise in something when they have spent 10, 15, 20 years. In today's age, I don't think so. The experience in negotiation matters. Just because you have been sitting at the table for so long. You have all the data, scenario, simulations. Every negotiation is a starting point from the scratch, but you have to analyze the historical behavior, especially for the new buyers. It doesn't matter, like I mentioned, how many years you have put in. Learn game theory in every aspect of the negotiation. It will change the way your organization negotiates. That's it. These were the 10 KPIs. A very long video, but a very fulfilling one. I've given you how the basic setup should work. I've given you how top 1% team will also perform. My name is Gaurav. I run something called Super Negotiate, my favorite thing in the entire world, which focuses upon open source digital procurement. And I only talk about spend analysis, negotiation, how to create top 1% teams for the center of excellence in procurement, and as well, procurement digitization. That's what I do. Thank you very much for watching this video. I hope you find it useful. If you like it, please share it with your colleagues. And I will see you in the next one. Thank you very much.